programme is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. Our first article today is entitled, The Misunderstood Reason Millions of Americans Stopped Going to Church. This was written by Jake Meador. Nearly everyone I grew up with in my childhood church in Lincoln, Nebraska, is no longer Christian. That's not unusual. 40 million Americans have stopped attending church in the past 25 years. That's something like 12% of the population, and it represents the largest concentrated change in church attendance in American history. As a Christian, I feel this shift acutely. My wife and I wonder whether the institutions and communities that have helped preserve us in our own faith will still exist for our four children, let alone whatever grandkids we might one day have. This change is also bad news for America as a whole. Participation in a religious community generally correlates with better health outcomes and longer life, higher financial generosity, and more stable families, all of which are desperately needed in a nation with rising rates of loneliness, mental illness, and alcohol and drug dependency. A new book, written by Jim Davis, a pastor at an evangelical church in Orlando, and Michael Graham, a writer with the Gospel Coalition, draws on surveys of more than 7,000 Americans by the political scientist Ryan Burge and Paul Juppé, attempting to explain why people have left churches, or de-churched in the book's lingo, and what, if anything, can be done to get some people to come back. The book raises an intriguing possibility. What if the problem isn't the churches are asking too much of their members, but they are not asking nearly enough? The Great De-Churching finds that religious abuse and more general moral corruption in churches have driven people away. This is, of course, an indictment of the failures of many leaders who did not address abuse in their church. But Davis and Graham also find that a much larger share of those who have left church have done so for more banal reasons. The book suggests that the defining problem driving out most people who leave is just how American life works in the 21st century. Contemporary America simply isn't set up to promote mutuality, care, or common life. Rather, it is designed to maximize individual accomplishment as defined by professional and financial success. Such a system leaves precious little time or energy for forms of community that don't contribute to one's own professional life or, as one ages, the professional prospects of one's children. Workism reigns in America. And because of it, community in America, religious community included, is a math problem that doesn't add up. Numerous victims of abuse in church environments can identify a moment when they lost the ability to believe, when they almost felt their faith draining out of them. The book shows, though, that for most Americans who were once part of churches but have since left, the process of leaving was gradual, and in many cases they didn't realize it was even happening until it already had. It's less like jumping off a cliff and more like driving down a slope, eventually realizing that you can no longer see the place you started from. Consider one of the composite characters in Graham and Davis use in the book to describe a typical evangelical de-churcher. A 30-something woman who grew up in a suburban megachurch, was heavily invested in a campus ministry while in college, then after graduating moved to a full-time job, began attending a young adults group in a local church. In her 20s, she meets a guy who is less religiously engaged. They get married, and at some point earlier in their marriage, after their first or second child is born, they stop going to church. Maybe the baby isn't sleeping well, and when Sunday morning comes around, it is simply easier to stay home and catch whatever sleep is available as the baby finally falls asleep. In other cases, a person might be entering mid-career, working a high-stress job requiring a 60 or 70-hour work week. Add to that 15 hours of commute time, and suddenly something like two-thirds of their waking hours in the week are already accounted for. And so when a friend invites them to a Sunday morning brunch, they probably want to go to church, but they also want to see that friend, because they haven't been able to see them for months. The friend wins out. After a few weeks of either scenario, the thought of going to church on Sunday carries a certain mental burden with it. You might want to go to church, but you also dread the inevitable questions about where you have been. I skipped church to go to brunch with a friend, or I was just too tired to come. Don't sound like convincing excuses as you rehearse the conversation in your mind. Soon, it actually sounds like it would be harder to attend than to skip, even if some part of you still wants to go. The underlying challenge for many is that their lives are stretched like a rubber band about to snap, and church attendance ends up feeling like an item on a checklist that's already too long. What can churches do in such a context? In theory, the Christian church could be an antidote to all that. What is more needed in our time than a community marked by sincere love, sharing what they have from each according to their ability and to each according to their need, eating together regularly, generously serving neighbors, and living lives of quiet virtue and prayer? A healthy church can be a safety net in the harsh American economy by offering its members material assistance in times of need. Meals after a baby is born, money for rent after a layoff. Perhaps more important, it reminds people that their identity is not in their job or how much money they make. They are children of God, loved and protected and infinitely valuable. But a vibrant, life-giving church requires more, not less, time and energy from its members. It asks people to prioritize one another over our career, to prioritize prayer and time reading scripture over accomplishment. This may seem like a tough sell in an era of de-churching. If people are already leaving, especially if they are leaving because they feel too busy and burned out to attend church regularly, why would they want to be part of a church that asks so much of them? Although understandable, that isn't quite the right question. The problem in front of us is not that we have a healthy, sustainable society that doesn't have room for a church. The problem is that many Americans have adopted a way of life that has left us lonely, anxious, and uncertain of how to live in community with other people. The tragedy of American churches is that they have been so caught up in this same world that we now find they have nothing to offer these suffering people that can't be more easily found somewhere else. American churches have too often been content to function as a kind of vaguely spiritual NGO, an organization of detached individuals who meet together for religious services that inspire them, provide practical life advice, or offer positive emotional experiences. Too often it has not been a community that through its preaching and living bears witness to another way to live. The theologian Stanley Hauerwas captured the problem well when he said that, quote, pastoral care has become obsessed with the personal wounds of people in advanced industrial societies who have discovered that their lives lack meaning, end quote. The difficulty is that many of the wounds and aches provoked by our current order aren't of a sort that can be managed or life hacked away. They are resolved only by changing one's life, by becoming a radically different sort of person, belonging to a radically different sort of community. Last fall, I spent several days in New York City, during which time I visited a home owned by a group of pacifist Christians that lives from a common purse, meaning the members do not have privately held property, but share their property and money. Their simple life and shared finances allow their schedules to be more flexible, making for a thicker immediate community and greater generosity to neighbors, as well as a richer life of prayer and private devotion to God, all supported by a deep commitment to their church. This is admittedly an extreme example, but this community was thriving not because it found ways to scale down what it asked of its members, but because it found a way to scale up what they provided to one another. Their way of living frees them from the treadmill of workism. Work in this community is judged not by the money it generates, but by the people it serves. In a workist culture that believes dignity is grounded in accomplishment, simply reclaiming this alternative form of dignity becomes a radical act. In the Gospels, Jesus tells his first disciples to leave their old way of life behind, going so far as abandoning their plow or fishing nets where they are, and, even if necessary, even leaving their behind their parents. A church that doesn't expect at least this much from one another isn't really a church in the way that Jesus spoke about it. If Graham and Davis are right, it also is likely a church that won't survive the challenges facing us today. The great de-churching could be the beginning of a new moment for churches, a moment marked less by aspiration to respectability and success, with less focus on individuals aligning themselves with American values and assumptions. We could be a witness to another way of life outside conventionally American measures of success. Churches could model better, truer sorts of communities, ones in which the hungry are fed, the weak are lifted up, and the proud are cast down. Such communities might not have the money, success, and influence that many American churches have so often pursued in recent years. But if such communities look less like those churches, they might look more like the sort of communities that Jesus expected his followers to create. Our second story is America's Coming Smoke Epidemic. The research on what smoke does to a body is just beginning. This was written by Zoe Schlanger. For 49 straight days, everyone in Sealy Lake was breathing smoke. A wildfire had ignited outside the small rural community in Montana, and the plume of smoke had parked itself over the houses. Air quality plummeted. At several moments, the concentration of particulate matter in the air exceeded the upper limit of what monitors could measure. Christopher Miglasio, an associate professor of immunology at the University of Montana, saw an opportunity to do what few have ever done: study what happens after people get exposed to wildfire smoke. He and his team quickly cobbled together funding and drove out to Sealy Lake to get data. That was in 2017. The researchers followed up with residents for 2 years after the fires, checking on their lung function. To their surprise, the worst effects didn't show up immediately, despite the heavy dose of smoke. Instead, people's lung function seemed to deteriorate later. Right after the fires, about 10% of the cohort had lung function that fell below the lower limit of normal. By the 1 year mark, about 46% did. And at the 2 year mark, most of those people still had an abnormally low lung function. "We were very surprised," Miglasio told me. He and his colleagues had intended to follow the residents for a third year, but then COVID hit. Instead, They tried exposing mice to wildfire smoke in a controlled lab environment. Their results pointed to a similar outcome. The worst effects took time to present. Miglacia's work can speak to only a single smoke event. But it is the type of event that more people in the United States are dealing with over and over again. Until recently, wildfires that exposed large populations to smoke were a relatively rare occurrence. But that's changing. More frequent and intense wildfires are erasing or even reversing decades of gains made in American air quality in the majority of U.S. states. Across the country, from 2012 to 2022, the number of people exposed to unhealthy air from wildfire smoke increased 27-fold. One out of every four unhealthy air days in parts of the country is now a smoke day. It is the exposure that is impacting air quality across the U.S. now more than any other pollution source. Joan Casey, an environmental epidemiologist at the University of Washington, whose work helped show a link between wildfire smoke and exposure and increased risk of dementia, told me. Yet science, to say nothing of policy, has hardly caught up with what that means for human health. We're in the preschool stage of development, Casey said. What cumulative smoke exposure can do to a body and mind remains largely a mystery, but the few studies that do exist point to nothing good. Plenty of research shows that respiratory distress and heart attacks spike in the event of smoke exposure. Acute impacts of breathing smoke send people to the hospital and make them miss work and school. Those risks can linger for months afterward, or in the case of the Sealy Lake cohort, for years. Now that more people are regularly breathing smoky air over their lifetime, though, the relevant concern may no longer be what happens when a person gets one big dose of smoke. Rather, it may be what happens when they are exposed many times. How much does anyone know about the long-term consequences of what exposure to smoke, or worse, the long-term consequences of long-term exposure to smoke? Very little, Mariantha Ann Kimortzoglou, excuse me with the pronunciation, an environmental engineer and epidemiologist, at Brown University, told me. The best model for assessing wildfire smoke exposure was developed only recently, Kimortzoglou and Casey told me, and because of satellite imagery and monitoring limitations, goes back to only 2006. That means researchers have at most 20 years of data to look at in determining whether smoke could have contributed to a population's incidence of a particular illness. Latency periods for plenty of diseases, including some cancers, can be longer. Plus, every fire is its own unique nightmare, chemically speaking. The Sealy Lake fire burned mostly trees. Add to that whole neighborhoods of cars and houses and parking lots, and the toxicity profile of the smoke changes significantly. During the Los Angeles fires in January, which burned down entire neighborhoods, noxious compounds from burning plastics and other man-made materials swirled through the air. Scientists know a lot about the harms of regular ambient air pollution, such as the particulate matter that spews from tailpipes and factories, but wildfire smoke is chemically different, and likely worse from a health standpoint. Its complexity is also daunting from a research perspective. Even the types of trees burned appeared to affect the smoke's toxicity. In a lab study, for instance, researchers burned peat, pine needles, and several types of wood to simulate different regional forests. They found that pine wood smoke was the most mutagenic, suggesting that it might be more likely to cause cancer than other woods, and that eucalyptus smoke was the most toxic to lungs. How long the smoke stays in the air may matter, too. Some research suggests that smoke becomes more toxic as it ages, which is bad news for people living downwind from smoke. In parts of the U.S., during Canadian wildfires, for instance. And like our relatively steady exposure to ambient air pollution, exposure to wildfire smoke is spiky, coming in bursts with pauses in between. That makes it hard to model, Hio Mortzoglou told me, and also introduces many questions, each of which needs research attention. Is the health impact worse if a person breathes a very high level of smoke for 3 days, or if they breathe a lower level for 3 weeks? How does the point in life at which they are exposed, as an adult with asthma, a child whose lungs are still developing, a fetus in utero, change how the smoke affects them? Many of the attempts to even start to answer these questions depend on chance and the swift action of researchers like Miglasio, who sees on the chance to study a fire close at hand. In the summer of 2008, for instance, Lisa Miller, who studies pulmonary immunology and toxicology at UC Davis, was in her office as wildfires sent smoke settling over the region. The air outside her office looked like thick winter fog. She suddenly thought about the rhesus monkeys she studied at the Primate Research Center. They had been outside in their habitat the whole time. These primates were great models for human health, so they became a case study for what happens to a smoke-exposed body. Miller and her team studied the monkeys for the next 15 years. They found that those that were exposed to wildfire smoke as infants became adolescents with smaller, stiffer lungs than their peers born the following year, which resulted in a poorer lung function and worse immune regulation. When the researchers exposed blood samples from both populations of adolescent monkeys to bacterial infection, the samples from the smoke-exposed animals responded more weakly, indicating that their immune system wasn't working as well. The smoke-exposed monkeys also slept far less, she told me. It was absolutely stunning. Some research suggests that smoke can affect humans the same way. In 2022, a large study in China concluded that human children who had been exposed to air pollution early in life also had poorer quality sleep. High-quality sleep is important to neurodevelopment in children, and poor sleep is associated with a range of negative health consequences across a lifetime. What we can learn from Miller's monkeys is limited. They spend 24 hours a day outdoors, unlike humans, and they get constant medical care and perfectly tailored diets, also unlike humans. Still, rhesus monkeys are some of the closest animals to us physiologically, and on a basic level, smoke exposure in infancy seems to have affected these monkeys' health for their entire life, Miller said. Standard air pollution is known to have a negative impact on virtually all aspects of fertility. And for people who wish to conceive children, smoke may pose a hazard too. After the wildfires in Oregon prompted an air quality emergency in Portland in 2020, researchers looked at the sperm quality of 30 people who had their semen analyzed at a fertility clinic before and after the fires. The study was small, but the trend was clear. Motility, how well the sperm swims, went down for most of the participants. A nearly identical study in Seattle, which is still awaiting peer review, yielded a similar result. And Luke Montrose, an environmental toxicologist at Colorado State University, told me that he's seen similar results in bull sperm. He and his colleagues got records from a cattle breeding facility in Colorado that tests bull sperm with many of the same metrics used for human sperm at a fertility clinic. Sperm that isn't up to shape gets discarded by the facility. After a wildfire in the area, more of the cattle sperm got thrown out, Montrose found. Quality must have gone down. The results on the bull sperm are preliminary and are awaiting peer review. But in the meantime, Montrose is enrolling male firefighters in a study to learn whether their fertility is affected by their job, which forces them to breathe much higher doses of smoke than the general population. When Montrose and his colleagues exposed mice to a very high dose of wood smoke in a lab, simulating what they estimate would be the equivalent of 15 years on the job for a wildland firefighter, the mouse sperm was significantly altered at the epigenomic level, where gene expression is altered without changing the underlying DNA sequence. Normally, in a study like this, you see a handful of sites being changed, Montrose told me. He and his colleagues found changes at more than 3,000 different sites, reflecting about 2,000 different genes. Montrose wonders what this far higher level means for the mice's fertility and for their offspring. Whether these changes are positive or negative, it appears that smoke can alter on a deep level the very cells involved in reproduction. It's intriguing, but we still don't quite know what it means, Montrose said. If smoke can affect health early in life, it can also affect life's end. Breathing smoke can cause inflammation, which is a key pathway for many neurological disorders, and research is now turning up associations between smoke and conditions that strike older people, such as Parkinson's, Casey told me. Smoke also causes premature death. More than 50,000 people in California died prematurely from wildfire smoke between 2008 and 2018, according to one estimate, and more than 11,000 people in the U.S. do so each year, according to another. Climate change is only accelerating those dynamics. As I've written before, the National Bureau of Economic Research found last year that in a worst-case warming scenario, deaths from wildfire smoke exposure in the U.S. could top 27,000 a year by the middle of the century. The smoke is coming for us all. Each of us is now more likely to encounter it in the coming years. This terrible reality means that researchers will have more opportunities to understand what smoke does to us. Scientists are aiming to answer these many questions before even more of the country starts having to ask them. I did have to cut that episode short because we have run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org.